Welcome to the Organ Podcast from the Royal College of Organists with me, Mark O'Brien. Well, right now, I'm outside the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, which is home to one of the more exciting organ departments around at the moment. And they're in the middle of an ambitious project of commissioning a range of new instruments that will represent nearly 500 years of organ design and sound, from historically inspired instruments to modern symphonic organs. Well, I'm about to meet Daniel Moult, the head of organ here, because I want to know how the design of an organ can inform musicianship and what young organ students today actually want to do with the instrument. Also in this episode, I meet one of the world's leading organists and improvisers, David Briggs. I talk to David about his work at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, improvising, and his many transcriptions.
You know, whether it's right to ethically correct to transcribe Mahler on the organ.
Is there an ethical problem?
Well, there could be, because, I mean, you're sort of, in a way, recasting the original. And I often think about this.
Well, that's all coming up later. But now I am in the organ studio at the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, aptly named because it's not one, but two organs in here, and the head of organ, Daniel Moult. Well, Daniel, these are not just practice instruments. You've commissioned these with specific intention.
Absolutely, Mark. So we will have, over the course of the next few years, five new organs, three existing organs, so a fleet, if what's a collective word of a
series of organs. I don't think there is one.
Should we call it fleet? A fleet of eight organs, which is thrilling. And what we wanted to do, because we're so blessed with such generous donors, is create a really varied playing experience so that our students here could experience everything from the technique and the sound of a 16th century mean tone organ right through to the challenges of playing an electro-pneumatic symphonic organ of the early 20th century and everything in between. Now, to do that with absolute authenticity, we'd need 25 organs. We've not quite got the space or fence for that, but what we are trying to do is just create the main boxes to tick, if you like, so that when you come here to study, you know, the mainstream of the repertoire, you get something of the different sounds and playing techniques to take away with you.
Are you doing something different here? I mean, referring back to your own experience when you were studying the organ, is this perhaps in response to something that you think perhaps was missing, really, when you and I were young organists studying?
Yes, I think I am filling in the gaps. I think we all do things differently from how our teachers did them, and I had some wonderful teachers, but everything has moved on so much that I think rather than reading textbooks and treatises, I think musicians now are more open-minded. There's less of those pedagogical wars that we're fighting in early music circles when we grew up. And perhaps now more it's about keeping an open mind, but also letting instruments, letting repertoire point you in certain ways rather than fighting turf wars over what musicologists say. It's been an enormous sort of shift of direction and tone. And one thing we're very much about here at RBC is creating unique musicians. I would feel something of a failure if all our graduates ended up sounding the same and if they have the same career. We're about, you know, making the individual musician, and the instruments here are part of that journey.
But how do you do this physically, practically? So you're sitting in front of, I mean, very beautifully decorated, a Flentrop organ, mm-hmm. and behind us, a new William Drake, you're calling it the Juliet organ. How is the organ informing the musicianship of your students?
The organ is absolutely critical, and to paraphrase Marie-Claire Alain, it's the greatest teacher. It's become something of a cliche, but she's absolutely right that with a little bit of guidance, this organ is giving huge amounts of feedback to the student that they can then take on into other musical situations. So, you know, we're not saying that hereafter all our students must play Schnitger pastiches or else you can't play early Bach and Buxtehude. Not at all. We're saying learn from the experience of what this organ is teaching you for that music, and then take that elsewhere.
Well, can you show that? I mean, in many ways, yeah. I don't know if it's about not just showing what this organ does with that sort of music, or perhaps what the organ doesn't allow you to do, maybe, in terms of how you play.
That's a really interesting point. I think I would phrase this what it likes and what it doesn't like. Mm. You know, and it's finding the parameters of what sits in the middle. So there's no one solution, but there are ways that it will encourage you to play. So let's have a listen.
Let's have a listen. I notice it's quite fun in this room. You've got the bellows and the blower exposed. You've got them over the doorway. There they go.
They're sort of in the roof, lovely pine, sort of naked bellows, as it were. And then the beautifully designed, I mean, you've got lovely woodwork here, two manual flintrock. The first thing I noticed, you've got the short keyboard, so that the length of the notes are very short.
The bulk of this is a pastiche of Arp Schnitger, an organ that he built in Dadersdorf. And that's not just because we're trying to create an academic copy, which has been done elsewhere in Europe, but just because the truer that we are to one organ type, the truer we are to a playing experience, which the student can then take and use however she or he wants to.
You've got a straight pedal board.
Yeah, it's very a short, pedal board, short sharp keys, notes. Which stops at D. Basically, if I approach this organ and I play it like a typical early 20th century electro-pneumatic action organ, then everyone says, oh, what a disappointing flintrop. Yeah, that sounds rather spitty and unformed. The sound's rather aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then the moment that I just listen to the wind and just behave on the key in a certain way, hopefully you can hear that there's a warmer sound.
So that's a physical response to the touch of the keys.
It's a physical response to the touch, absolutely. And also listening to what the wind does. And the easiest way to demonstrate this, actually, it's more obvious and a bigger sound. So if I just draw a planum of sorts, and then I'm just going to play it as it comes. And now I'm going to just be a little bit more mindful of my touch. And I'm also listening to the wind, so I'm just having to breathe with the instrument a little bit more deliberately. Oh yeah, there's a sort of subtle difference there, but I could maybe exaggerate a little bit more if I push the parameters. Lots of consonants, a rather ugly, slightly jolty sound that you're hearing. Mm. And now if I just calm everything down,
and do you find students coming here have this sudden shock when they're playing an instrument like this?
Absolutely, and it reminds me of the first time that I played a very famous historic instrument in Amsterdam, and I sounded dreadful. My teacher turned round and said, "It's not the organ, it's you," which was the most humbling thing that I had to learn in my early 20s. And it does that people sit down, and even if they can get around the pedal board, the fact that you've got completely different console dimensions, they will often sound quite jolty and jerky. And the wind will sound a bit asthmatic. And then you meet the organ on its own terms and you work out that you can make a beautiful sound, breathe with the wind. It takes time.
But it's a question of technique as much as listening.
Yes,
is it really listening?
I mean, it is. It's about technique as well. And it's about the ergonomics of controlling the key. It's about soft releases. It's about both staggering and coordinating releases. All these things that we teach on these organs and some of the mechanical action practice organs. But here it's like in multicolour. You know, often on a modern mechanical action instrument, you get a sense of something misbehaving. Here, you really have to be beautifully technically controlled to make the organ sound well. It will also tell you a maximum speed you can play as well.
I mean, that's interesting, because at what level is this transferable? Because it's all very well having a bespoke instrument like this for a particular sort of repertoire, so Bach, the early music. But a lot of the time, and you would do this, you'll be playing Bach on, you know, perhaps a big old Willis with fat diapasons, large reeds and electric action. That's actually probably quite a challenge, just as much as playing on an instrument like this.
It absolutely is, Mark, and it's an excellent point. And I think, you know, in the world that we're living in, this postmodern world where, you know, we're no longer, if you like, have to follow slavishly the idea of history and historical copies, this is giving information. And I think with that information, we do what we want and we translate it how we want. You could go and play Bach on a Willis and play entirely in a Walter Parrott way. You can go and play Bach on a Zauer, and it makes sense to play it like Reger with crescendos and lots of rubato. So I think, you know, one can look at it completely differently and say, this organ is an irrelevance. But to me as a musician, we're all about absorbing as much as we can and then using the information in whatever way that we want to. So the very experience of playing, say, Buxtehude early Bach on an organ like this, I think just stays with whoever plays it. how they use it is up to them. It also makes them a more refined musician and a better technician, because I think to play this organ and make a nice sound is a real challenge. And I think that also transfers to completely different playing styles. So one thing I've noticed, and it wasn't a surprise, but I've noticed that people who get really, students who get really good playing the flentrop, the level of control when they're playing franc and dupraying, completely different techniques.
Oh,
completely different techniques. They're listening and their control with a different playing style and with different use of wrists and hands, but it's still got more control because that's the sort of discipline that one thing feeds another. And when you're playing the organ, there's so many holistic connections that we have.
So in an odd sort of way, I would be looking at this as specialist, but actually what you're saying, no, it enables you to be generalist.
Yeah, it would be a bit of an indulgence, I think, to have this here if we didn't think that it had really important, a real significance for every student that comes through the door. Mm. You know, it would be a bit of a vanity project. But I passionately believe, and so do my colleagues here, that this is critical for creating really good musicians and people who listen to the sound that they're creating on the instrument. And that transfers, as you say, to the Willis with a detached console, as it does to a little mean-tone organ that's arriving next year in the corner.
What are the students coming here? What are they wanting to do?
It's really interesting, I think, how perspectives have changed and continue to change since COVID. I think now if you spoke to the students, you probably find a cross-section, those who still want to do cathedral and church music entirely, but I think more and more are wanting to do a portfolio career. And I think that's how the music profession is going, that, you know, they want to play the organ, but they acknowledge that they will almost certainly do lots of different things with that. They'll be teaching, they'll be examining, they might be editing music, they'll be, you know, maybe doing some church work, they'll be doing some concert work, a whole mix. And I think that both gives professional security, and it's also, I think, how the profession has sort of moved on, that we've not perhaps got these same completely contained careers that were the case when I was growing up 30 or so years ago.
In terms of being in Britain, how do the career opportunities that are available to organists as musicians and performers, how does that compare to the rest of the world?
I think those of us in the UK know that financially there are better places to be. And we have had students go over to the States. I can think of a few in recent years, and they're developing really good careers out there and probably earning quite nicely from it. We've also had quite a number of students over the last 10 years settle into Germany, doing postgrad work, working over there as well. And again, there's perhaps more of an established career path there. But for those of us who remain in the UK for whatever reason it is, I like to think that we're giving them every opportunity to succeed and help them on the way. Interestingly, we do get people from overseas who come because we are English, and they say, well, we want to study English repertoire, whether that's Bird or Purcell, or more often Elgar and Whitlock. And it's interesting how, yeah, repertoire, which I think when I grew up was a bit like, oh dear, you're English, you don't have the best organ music. I think now in sort of mainland Europe and the States, there's a real embracing of that repertoire. And the best of it, I think, is very worthy. And, you know, we've got a German student, top German student, coming over next year. And he's really fired up by going around the country, playing Elgar and Whitlock and Howells on organs that's appropriate. Also coming here with a new Juliet Drake organ and playing Parry and Stamford and getting into that sound
world.
I mean,
you're right. I mean, when I was growing up, if in my organ class somebody played Whitlock, we would laugh at them. I mean, even though it's, you know, we probably secretly love music. So what is it about? Is there a resurgence in what probably never was a really solid English style? I mean, where's that coming from?
That's a fascinating question. Is it that pendulums always swing? And they never swing back in the same place. So when we were growing up, you know, being educated, say, in the 90s, there was a reaction against the perception of our generation above, or even two generations above, who loved their Howells and their Whitlock. That's just regarded as passé. And let's be honest, not all of it is top quality. There's probably a small amount of, you know, real worthwhile music in that area. And I guess that, yeah, like anything, every action has a reaction. And I think we're now seeing that reaction and, you know, an acceptance of the best that was English. So here with our own students, we give them absolute cross-sections, Sphalink to Messiaen and beyond, because that's important. The students who come from overseas, they often want more of an English accent. So that's fine. We focus more on the Bird and the Purcell, the Handel, you know, the Elgar.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
I think, but in your experience, is there one country that right now is the leading light in terms of organ culture and organ playing?
You know, the grass is always greener, isn't it? And I think if I had a gun to my head, I'd say that perhaps Germany is still where it's at, in my perception. But speaking to some German colleagues, they tell me of frustrations and, you know, concerns as well about not just organ culture, but classical music culture at large. But I'd say that perhaps Germany is still culturally where the organ art is perhaps at its most fulsome. And I think what we want to do in Birmingham, what we've striven to do over the last 10 or 15 years, is adhere to that sort of philosophy that we treat the organ and organ playing very seriously in itself, whilst we acknowledge that the career of a concert organist is probably a bit of a bygone thing, but people will come here to invest in their playing as well. They have, you know, sessions with choral directing, harmony, everything else that makes up a musician, but, you know, the focus is on the organ.
And the students you're getting, though, in terms of the general musical maturity that they would need outside of the organ repertoire, what are you learning from your students? I mean, are they coming with a diverse influence or a diverse musical influence? I mean, how would that compare with perhaps two or three generations ago? Is it more? Is it less? Are you having to fill in a lot of gaps, or are you surprised?
I think maybe it's 50-50. I think the general standard of playing, both of people that we accept and also of young people at large, you know, the sector, if you like, the 18 to 25 at other institutions, my perception is that generally the standard of playing is higher and more polished than it has been. And I think the students are every bit, if not more, committed than when I was a student. I think maybe that generationally, I'm very, you know, I'm very pro Generation X and Generation Z. I know there's lots of nasty attributes thrown at them in society, but I think by and large, they are actually a sincere and a hardworking generation. There are gaps in their education because of, you know, the disgraceful collapse of so much music education outside the private sector. So that's a minus. Having said that, I have wonderful colleagues at the Conservatoire who still teach traditional history and, you know, harmony and counterpoint with an instrument focus. You're writing essays related to your instrument. So they will leave, hopefully, with the gaps filled that they didn't get at A-level. And that's very important.
And so in your position here, you're generally then encouraged by what you're seeing and what I guess is going to be the organist of the imminent future.
I am 95% encouraged. I really am.
That's a good margin.
That's a good margin, isn't it? The world's not perfect, but I genuinely am. And I just see, you know, recent graduate students we've got coming through, students who are interested in the next few years, and it's really, really positive. And not only are they lovely and wonderful people to work with, but they also, they realise the profession's changing. You know, they realise there's easier ways to make money if that's all that life is about, but they are following their passion, and I think that's just wonderful. And yet they're also more mature and open-minded than I was in my late teens and early 20s, in that they realise at some point, you know, they've got to be realistic and find out their own path professionally through this.
Daniel Mole, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
This is the fourth movement of Mahler's Second Symphony, transcribed for organ and played here by David Briggs on a recording made at Blackburn Cathedral. And it's just a small part of an extraordinary portfolio of orchestral transcriptions that David has arranged for organ from composers such as Mahler, Ravel, Brahms, Schumann, and Tchaikovsky. And this is alongside well over 60 of his own instrumental and choral compositions. Well, when he's not doing all of that, David is artist in residence at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York and keeps up a demanding international recital career.
And he's widely regarded as one of the finest improvisers in the world today. Well, I met up with David when he was over here in the UK recently, and I began by asking him about his role at St John the Divine.
I love what the cathedral stands for. I would say, in fact, that it's by far my happiest position so far. Wonderful liturgy, wonderful music, fantastic social awareness, great outreach, very, very liberal in all respects. But most of all, just the most fantastic people. And my position there is quite unusual, that I just play something like six or seven times a year. I always play at Christmas and Easter and play maybe four concerts a year. I write a couple of pieces for the choir each year. You know, it gives me time to be very flexible with my travelling schedule and time to write a lot as well. So, but when I am at home in New York, which is probably around about half of the year, I have pretty much unrestricted access during the evenings to rehearse in that building. And it's being there alone at night is just the most wonderful thing.
But of course, the organ, the famous pipe organ there, has been out of action for a number of years.
Yes.
You're doing a lot of your work on an electronic, a digital organ.
Yes.
In the cathedral.
You're absolutely right, Mark. We had a fire actually the day before Notre Dame.
Oh, God.
We had a little accident in one of the small rooms in the basement of the cathedral, in the crypt. And it was in the middle of the Palm Sunday Mass. And people smelt this new aroma, you know, and I think everybody thought it was like a new type of incense or something until the fire alarm went off and the red fire trucks came and they came in. And of course, the cathedral was evacuated. The organ just suffered really some smoke damage. So what's happened is that the whole of the instrument, all the pipes of 8 feet and smaller, have gone back to Warrensburg, Missouri, to the Quimby Organ Factory. They did a magnificent restoration of the organ back in 2008. So we've been without the organ for a whole 5 years, and we obtained the use of this really remarkable organ by the Walker Technical Company from Pennsylvania. And I mean, I would say, in truth, that it's the first electronic organ I've really fallen in love with. I mean, it sounds very, very impressive in the cathedral. It's set up very well, enormous gantries for the speakers, very powerful amplifiers.
And you give recitals on it. I mean, it hasn't stopped you. It hasn't held you back.
And I mean, you know, during the pandemic, when the cathedral was closed for, I think, about 18 months, actually, it was a real lifeline for me to go in. And, you know, I did a lot of rehearsal on it, a lot of recording, because I had all this time to practice. I finally got things learnt properly that I should have learnt much more thoroughly 30 years ago.
Well, America is your home. It's been your home for probably about 23 years.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're British. You grew up in Birmingham and you were an organ scholar at King's College, Cambridge.
Yes.
And before leaving to the States, I think you amassed three cathedrals under your belt, Hereford, Truro and Gloucester.
Yes.
Post there. America's now your home. Is that right?
Very much. I actually have two passports, a blue one and a red one.
Having had so much experience in the English sound, English cathedrals, is there a difference for you playing in America?
There is. I mean, you know, my most of my playing in America is for concerts. And I mean, I've been actually playing in the States, I suppose, since 1994. I was lucky enough to win the improvisation competition at St. Albans in 93. And part of the prize for that was representation by Philip Truckenbrod, the American concert agency. So I started doing a lot of touring in the late 90s in America. And the audiences are different, for sure. I mean, the whole kind of ethos, I think, is different. There's a lot of private philanthropy with the concert series in the US. And also,
does that mean bigger organs, better organs, more organs?
That's a good question. I think just a lot of the recital series themselves are sponsored, you know, by individuals, which is
so better organists for bigger organists.
Maybe on the whole, larger fees, I guess. Mm. You know, to be absolutely honest. But I'm extremely fortunate and absolutely love what I do. Probably this year, about 65 concerts, I guess, and about half of those are in Europe, and half in the US. And so it's for me a very happy balance.
And what about the instruments? Because presumably there aren't the great historic instruments that you'd find in Europe and the continent. But nevertheless, is there an American sound?
There is. There very much is. I mean, it's a sort of smorgasbord in a way. I mean, the organs at the beginning of the 20th century in the US, a lot of them were built by builders like Hooke and Hastings, and especially Ernest Skinner, who really inherited a lot of the sound world of Henry Willis, actually, from this country. I mean, I love the very blended and symphonic nature of the Skinner organs. And then in the middle of the 20th century, the American classic organ came into being, which was, I always think it's the sort of musical equivalent of Fifth Avenue with all the yellow cabs and the you know, everybody on their horns, even though it says don't honk. It's very full of razzle-dazzle and metallic sort of brilliance and fire. Very, very bright sound, very incisive. But I think now, I mean, it's a real mixing pot. A lot of organs in the US are being built sort of on the model of the Romantic tradition, both the German Romantic organs and especially, I suppose, the French Romantic organs. Although it's always interesting to me that Marcel Dupré especially absolutely loved the organs of Ernest Skinner. Mm. You know, he loved the American sound. And very intriguing that Louis Vierne, the organist of Notre Dame, in 1932 had a plan to have an American-style console at Notre Dame because he enjoyed playing in the States so much.
Are the organs treated differently in their liturgical role?
I think it varies a lot. Mm. You know, a lot of the big programs in the cathedrals in the US are kind of modelled on the British style, I think, you know, with evensong and sort of style of playing. Hymns, I think, in the US is kind of different to hear. If we went up a semitone in a hymn, we'd sort of be, think, gosh, that was a little bit unusual. But you hear that kind of thing a lot in the US. And things like the introductions to the hymns, you know, very often American organists will improvise for 30 seconds to introduce a hymn, which I think is always rather fun. The way I was brought up at King's is, of course, to play it absolutely straight with the soprano and the alto in the right hand, the tenor in the left hand, the pedal playing and the bass part, and there it is kind of thing. But for me, the more improvising, the better.
Is there much improvising in America?
There is in places. I mean, there's some wonderful improvisers in the US. I would say that there's not the tradition of teaching it.
So how do things when you improvise in the concert programme in the States then? How is that received? Because then presumably that's slightly a novelty in certain areas.
Yeah.
How does it go down?
It always goes down very well. I mean, I try to explain a lot about what people are going to hear and what to listen out for. And I suppose my sort of main priority in a way is to try and give the impression that the audience are listening to something that could have been composed. You know, that has a very clearly recognisable form, plenty of development, plenty of variety, and plenty of energy.
So do you prepare quite a lot? I mean, how spontaneous would one of your improvisations be? I mean, are you literally off the cuff, or are you thinking about a structure, modulations or themes in your head to a certain level?
Maybe 10, 15 seconds.
Right, so it's off the cuff.
It's off the cuff, yeah.
But then how do you get the structure? I mean, you really letting serendipity take its chance, or do you have quite, you know, a level of control?
You know, it's really composing on the spot. It's the same as composition, but speeded up about 100,000 times. Except, of course, you don't have the delete button, so you're really living dangerously in a way. But the rules for the improviser are exactly the same as for the composer. Whether you're improvising in the style of Bach or Mozart or Brahms or Liszt or Debussy or Ravel or whoever, Duroflé, the rules are exactly the same of harmony and counterpoint and form and orchestration. So it's just a matter of a sort of subconscious element of, you know, you use, I suppose, techniques that have been built up over quite a few years.
I mean, I've heard a lot of your improvising. To me, it sounds like you use more of the contrapuntal and more of structure than perhaps other people might when improvising. That perhaps there's less of being aware that you're filling to think of the next thing to do, but there is a structure development that is actually taking place as you say, as if it could have been written down.
My teacher in Paris, Jean Langlais, he was all the time talking about counterpoint, multi-layering, so that, you know, it's not always just the tune in the right hand, the harmonies in the left, and a bass line, but actually as if it was being played perhaps by five different people, you know, all of whom have interesting linear lines development, so that it's a proper balance between the harmonic generosity and nuance and what's happening from the linear point of view.
But you have perfect pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that helps?
Yeah.
Really?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, the essential when you're playing is that you have to be able to hear what you're going to do just a split second before you play it. If your hands are ahead of your ears, you can suddenly hear that, you know, if there's not enough oral. I mean, improvisation really is an oral tradition. I think it's an oral art.
You go into this in a big way because one of your main influence, I think, for improvising is Pierre Cochereau,
yes.
You know, legendary organist, 50s, yeah. 60s, 70s, 80s at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
You actually transcribed, you took 11 years transcribing, I think, most of his improvisations. Why go to that level?
Well, I remember hearing him for the first time when I was a choir boy on an LP. I was 10 years old. And my dad, I remember saying, gosh, he thought my headphones were like surgically attached to my head because I was completely in love with this sound, with the harmonies, with the sound of the Notre Dame organ, with his absolutely incredible improvising. And that sort of stayed with me. And then actually, I think it was in 1986 when I was the assistant organist at Hereford, just really to sharpen my own oral skills and to find out more about his harmonic language, I just set about transcribing a little bit just with the headphones and listening to it bar by bar and writing it out sort of note by note.
In some way, did that shatter an illusion? Because you're seeing something that's improvisatory and now you're putting it into its structures. You're seeing it in bare black and white. Did you sometimes think, I see 32 repeated quavers in the left hand here while the melody is in the octave? Or did you learn, I mean, did it really open your eyes? I mean, how was that experience? Because that's an unusual thing to do, I think.
It is. I mean, I sometimes think it's a little bit like when Bach copied out the whole of the Premier Livre d'Orgue of de Grigny. You know, he did that because he wanted to find out what was happening in the great French classical tradition, especially with the harmony and all these, you know, wonderful suspensions and this great harmonic language that composers like Couperin and de Grigny used all the time. So I think with Cochereau, I mean, my primary interest really was to find out about his harmonic language. And you can really see direct lineage, I think, from what people like Debussy and Ravel were doing in the 1890s and 1910s, 1920s.
Do you think Cochereau is groundbreaking in terms of the organ world, of his style of improvising?
Yes.
Really?
Now, I mean, I'm lucky enough to be invited to many juries in the States and also a lot in Europe, in Holland and in France, Germany. And I think the influence of Cochereau on the current generation of improvisers is absolutely enormous. He would be, I think, very proud of that. He described actually improvisation as an art that was on its way out. He was very concerned that people weren't interested in improvising anymore. But I think that he really turned that around. And I think that the fact that everything he improvised in Notre Dame from 1968 until his premature death on the 6th of March 1984, everything was recorded. So there are literally thousands of sorties, thousands of preludes, hundreds of improvised symphonies. There's an incredible legacy all on reel to reel.
From your point of view, in a sentence, what makes a good improvisation?
I'd say a generous harmonic nature and a really good sense of construction and something that never goes on too long.
What's a bad improvisation? Because you must have heard many.
I think it's something that sounds improvised.
Oh. But that's tricky to work that one out. I mean, surely, how would you work?
What I'm really getting at is when a favourite phrase of my teacher, Jean Langlais, he used to say, on ne peut pas improviser l'improvisation. it's impossible to improvise improvisation. There must always be a strong compositional element to it. I think a bad improvisation is something that's static, you know, something that stays in the key too long, has no sense of climax or development.
Who are the best improvisers in terms of countries? Would you say it's still in France? Is it England? Where do you think, you know, the shining lights of improvising?
I think it's still Paris.
Really?
You know, in my...
But that's a few people. We're talking a handful of people, really.
Right, exactly. But I mean, they are iconic. You know, people like Philippe Lefebvre and Olivier Latry and Vincent Dupuis at Notre Dame. And in the younger generation, you know, people like Thomas Hopital at Saint-Eustache. I mean, incredible voices, really.
Well, apart from improvising, probably one of the things you're most famous for is transcribing, your transcription work. I mean, kind of on another level, really. I mean, what, 6 Mahler symphonies? I mean, these are huge projects that you do. I'm wondering, is the reason for that perhaps a response to something that you think is missing from the organ repertoire, that level of symphonic music?
No.
What is it? What's the reason you do all of this?
I just love orchestral music.
And you just want to play it?
I just want to play it on my own instrument, yeah. I mean, I adore the organ, the indigenous repertoire for the organ. I mean, it's the best thing, you know? I mean, it's so rich. I would be very happy, you know, just playing that, of course. But I adore Mahler, and I adore Strauss, and I adore Debussy, and I adore Brahms. And, you know, whether it's right to ethically correct to transcribe Mahler on the organ...
Is there an ethical problem?
Well, there could be, because, I mean, you're sort of, in a way, recasting the original. And I often think about this, you know, and also with Koshra, you know, these transcriptions that I've made of music that is supposed to be, was ephemeral when it was made. You know, it wasn't invented to be transcribed.
So. You're transcribing the Koshra work. Yeah. You're transcribing, hopefully, it's a faithful reproduction of what he did.
Yeah.
Mahler, very obviously, there aren't enough fingers and hands and feet to play the orchestral resources that he composed with. So I suppose you're having to reject just as much as what you think you want to include.
And some people say, oh, it's a reduction. Mm. But I think not so much a reduction as a recasting. I mean, a lot of it is due to the registrations you choose as well. And I mean, the work that I've done, I'm very faithful to the dynamics and the articulations and the tempi of the original. But the registration, I just leave to the good taste of the performer, you know, because I think it's so different at every location. It depends what organ you're playing and the acoustic and so on.
Presumably it's very restrictive. I mean, Elgar I can get, but Mahler, Mahler too. I mean, you do need a St. John the Divine or a St. Paul's Cathedral, really, to pull something like that off.
You need something with a lot of colour. I mean, it's not the same as the orchestra. That's not really the intention.
I mean, I think for a lot of people, Mahler is quite hard work, even, you know, if the Berlin Phil are doing it. Mm-hmm. If you're in a church or a cathedral, that must be very difficult. I mean, if it's not really like an old-fashioned Victorian transcription, bringing music to the masses because, you know, they can't go and hear an orchestra, then what are they supposed to get from that then?
Well, I think, I mean, it's different to the orchestra, of course. But, I mean, I think they should be aware of an equally large palette of colour to the orchestra. You know, the end of Mahler 2, the last 10 minutes, on the tutti of a really great organ with a great choir. I mean, it's kind of stunning because the music itself, the raw material is so stunning.
But how do you do it? I mean, are you there with software and you've got a score, or are you there with a manuscript and a pen?
The last time I used a pencil as a composer was in 2003.
Right.
Yeah. You know, in my job, I travel a lot. So a lot of transcriptions, a lot of new music that I write is written in airport lounges, hotel rooms, transatlantic flights. It all goes straight into Sibelius for me. Yeah.
But you do a lot. So you're recycling all over the world. You take on commissions, you're transcribing, you're teaching. You compose and interesting collaborations with organ and different instruments and choral works.
Yes.
What's next? Have you got anything still to do?
I just like to keep doing what I'm doing. I mean, I'm extremely fortunate and I love what I do. And I mean, I've got a few more orchestral pieces I'd like to get under my belt. One of the best things about traveling a lot is just meeting all these wonderful people and then establishing new relationships and then maintaining them. So, I mean, a lot of the places I've played, you know, I've been 3, 4, 5 times before, and that's, I love that.
And which bit out of all the things you do you love the most? Where are you most relaxed and fully David Briggs?
I think in my imagination, I'm always in the Organ Tribune at Notre Dame.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. David Briggs, thank you very much.
You're
indeed.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for now. Next time, I meet Hauptwerk genius Richard McVeigh, who's gone global with his YouTube platform, Beauty and Sound. And I also talk to one of the UK's most established and influential teachers of the organ, Anne Marsden Thomas. But let's go back to David Briggs and end with him playing his own transcription of a Pierre Cochereau improvisation on the French nursery rhyme Alouette, Gentille Alouette. He's playing it here on the Walker Technical Company digital organ, currently being used at St John the Divine.